Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to another episode of our Talking Markets podcast series right here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Joining me for the conversation today, glad to welcome back Patricia Zobel, Senior Managing Director and Head of Macroeconomic Research and Market Strategy for Guggenheim Partners Investment Management. Patricia, welcome back. It's nice to have you back here up at the studio. Thank you for spending some time with our listeners and clients. I know you were last on with us back in October of 2024. A lot has happened in between, so we do have a lot to talk about and catch up on today. Welcome back.
Well, Dan, it's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me back.
Absolutely. It's great to have you back. So where to begin? A lot top of mind, of course, for investors at the moment. Perhaps we can begin with U.S. trade policy tariffs, since that seems to be driving so much of the economic and investment outlook at the moment. And even as we're speaking, we've seen a lot develop even in the past 24 hours with respect to U.S. and China. Over this past weekend, we did see an announced deal involving the U.S. and the European Union, though a lot still, of course, remains outstanding as we're quickly approaching the August 1st tariff deadline, just a couple of days away at this point. So how do you anticipate, Patricia, that U.S. trade policy will evolve from here over the near term and through the balance of 2025?
Well, it's a great question because it is something that's influencing everyone's outlooks. The recent push on trade agreements is kind of bringing down the uncertainty around ultimate tariff level, but it doesn't look like it's going to result in lower tariff rates, and there's still a lot to be learned. Still, the recent negotiations are giving us some sense of the administration's approach, and I think we're learning, in my mind, three things. One, the base tariff rate is likely to go up. You know, it has been 10%, and it looks like for most countries it's going to be 15% as a base rate. Second, the administration is really focused on reducing tariff evasion. So they're employing transshipment tariffs on countries to make sure that companies aren't evading tariffs by transshipping them through other countries. But on the other hand, you know, the administration has shown some flexibility on sector tariffs, and we weren't sure that that would be the case. So they reduced auto tariffs for, as you said, Europe and Japan from 25% to 15%. Still, there are more sector tariffs coming on things like semiconductors and pharmaceuticals, so there's more uncertainty there. But on balance, you know, I think tariffs are likely to be about the same or slightly higher than they are right now. Even though it's much better than the worst case outcome, tariffs are still elevated. And this process is likely to be drawn out. As you said, you know, we're reaching some agreements now. There's the August 1st deadline. And then, you know, we're going to have a series of new agreements over time. So it's still a large tax on households and businesses. Tariff levels right now are up from around 2% at the beginning of this year to around 15%. That's a historically large tax increase on the sector. And there's still a lot to be resolved. The China negotiations are ongoing, and there's still the court case outstanding on the emergency authority tariffs. For us, we're looking at a tariff rate of around 16% as a base case with a wide band of uncertainty still around that. We're also seeing the impact on the economy as likely to be drawn out as well. We're just beginning to see the effects. The key question is who will absorb the tariff increases. It has to be either foreign suppliers, businesses, or consumers. So far, there's not much evidence that it's going to be foreign suppliers. You know, there's isolated cases like Japanese automakers that are absorbing the tariff costs, but overall, import prices have been stable, and those would be falling if overseas suppliers were paying the tariff. So if it's not foreign suppliers, you know, it's going to have to be split between U.S. businesses and consumers. So far, though, the pass-through to consumer prices has been modest. Goods prices are creeping up, but and we're seeing some evidence in June. But overall, it's been more muted than one might have expected. In part, this is delayed effects, but we're also holding open the possibility that the pass-through will be a little bit less than we had been anticipating. So I think what I would leave you with is it's still early in this process. Our base case is that core inflation is going to rise to a little more than 3% by the end of 2025, but the process is going to be protracted, and we're still learning a lot in coming months.
And the markets seem to be taking it in stride. It's interesting how the markets seem to be holding steady with so much still to be figured out when you think about the economic impacts. Patricia, as you pointed out, as well as a deal still yet to be reached, notably with China, but you think about Canada and even Mexico as well. So a lot still coming down the pike with trade. Moving over to legislation a bit, heading into the 4th of July holiday, and this is now, of course, law, but a lot of anticipation over President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill. Now that that has been signed into law, what are your thoughts in terms of the overall potential economic impact of that?
So, you know, the bill was a key piece of legislation for the administration, really a cornerstone of their policy approach. We expect it to provide modest stimulus in 2026, but anticipate that that will fade pretty quickly in subsequent years. And this is really because the tax cuts that boost growth are front-loaded in the early years, while the cost savings are going to kick in later. Businesses and consumers are going to get new tax cuts in 2026, but most of those sunset by 2029. And in particular, research and development, depreciation, and greater interest deductibility could really spur some growth in 2026, but that will be sunsetting. And households will also benefit from temporary tax cuts, which should help support consumers next year. Cost savings, you know, on the other hand, are mostly in the form of reduced transfer payments, and those are phased in through the later years, and that will ultimately weigh on growth. Changes to Medicaid and SNAP program ramp up in 2028, and at the same time, the green energy credits are being phased out. So really, on balance, we expect fiscal stimulus to help offset the drag from growth in tariffs in 2026. Our base case is around 0.5% on growth in that year, fading, like I said, in 2027. And that's the balance of the growth impact. Given the size of the bill, this may seem modest, and that we see really two reasons for that. First, the fiscal multiplier, which is the bill's growth impact per dollar of spend, might not be that high. Higher income consumers that get tax cuts tend to save more of their income, and spending cuts that affect lower income households, they tend to pare back spending for every dollar of lost benefit. So overall, the multiplier might be a low mix. And the second reason is really that deficits only spur growth when they expand. So even though deficits stay wide under the One Big Beautiful Bill, it's only the initial boost that spurs growth. And after that, the effects fade. And when I think about it, you know, these wide deficits are really going to be an issue longer term, because fiscal sustainability is a growing concern in the United States. And so that's something that we're watching. The issue is that U.S. deficits have now become somewhat structural. We're running kind of the widest ever deficits in a peacetime expansion. And the current level of debt isn't unsustainable, but in coming years, debt to GDP will rise to historically high levels because of these wide deficits. Right now, term premiums have risen only modestly, and this, you know, reflects the faith that U.S. will ultimately make the necessary adjustments. But the risk is that at some point, investors are going to require higher term premiums. And that's something to watch carefully in coming years.
So a lot of considerations there, perhaps not front and center in the minds of investors at the moment, but something we need to watch out for over the longer term. Just out of curiosity, because when we last spoke, there were a lot of concerns over recession back in October, but that never really materialized. So just looking at the state of the U.S. economy today, how would you characterize its current health, and mindful that we have a big labor report coming out in just a few days as well for July?
Yeah, that will be a key watch point, because the labor market holding in is one of the reasons why this economy, while it's slowing, doesn't appear to be falling into recession. You know, the U.S. economy is at an interesting transition point. You know, as we discussed, the tariff effects are just beginning to be felt. The fiscal stimulus is still ahead. But what we have seen is that high policy uncertainty is already dragging on growth. It's not just sentiment, which has been widely reported that has been weak. You know, the hard data are showing a softening in consumer spending. In particular, consumers are lightening up on discretionary spending, things like travel, large durable purchases. And so what we're seeing is domestic demand, which is the important component to watch through the quarters, is slowing already. Our base case, you know, on balance is that growth will slow to probably sub 1% overall this year as tariffs hit real incomes and profits, and that that'll recover modestly in 2026 as fiscal stimulus kicks in. But as you said, the underlying strength of the economy, in particular the healthy household balance sheets, elevated corporate profitability, seem like they're going to forestall a recession this year. We do think, ultimately, sluggish growth is going to start to feed through to the labor market, and we're going to see unemployment rise this year. You know, the labor market is a cornerstone of the consumer, which is 70% of the economy. And while it's held up so far, when you look under the hood, there are some vulnerable points. Hiring continues to be low, and layoffs, it's really low layoffs that are keeping the unemployment rate from rising. So for us, we're looking for slower growth this year and rising unemployment gradually, but not for a recession.
So as far as the role the Fed may play going forward, and again, it's timely, Patricia, you're joining us today as the Fed is set to unveil their rate decision tomorrow, Wednesday, July 30th at 2 p.m. Eastern. Our chief investment office here at UBS expects the Fed to hold steady, though I'm curious to hear about your expectations for monetary policy through the back half of 2025. And how should investors be thinking about disruption to Fed independence as well? Because that has been coming up a lot lately in the headlines.
Yeah, those are great issues to be thinking about. There's a lot of diverse opinions on the FOMC themselves about what the appropriate stance of policy is right now. Against the backdrop of large policy shifts and uncertain effects on the economy, it's really not surprising that FOMC participants might have different views on what the appropriate rate setting is right now. As you noted, we're not either expecting, and I don't think very many people are expecting, a rate cut tomorrow. They've been pretty clear about that, but we do think we're going to see possibly one or two dissents as people have differing views. You know, what's interesting to me is that absent impending tariff inflation, we would probably be seeing rate cuts right now. There's been continued progress toward the committee's 2% objective, and the labor market, while holding in, continues to cool, and it might be time to be reducing the restrictiveness of monetary policy. But with tariff effects lying ahead, and many on the FOMC would like to see more information. So my expectation is that September is going to be a live meeting for the Fed to consider and to take into account the wide range of data that we're going to get between here and there, including the labor market report. You know, I think their assessment is, with unemployment currently low, the costs of waiting to see how much tariff effects will impact inflation are pretty low. You know, so I think that will keep them on hold, at least until September. With that, I think the labor market is really going to be essential to watch. If longer-run inflation expectations remain anchored, we see a weakening labor market as sufficient for them to ease. You know, they're weighing the costs and benefits of the timing of rate cuts. And if the ultimate inflation impact is still uncertain, but they're clearly seeing labor market weakness, I think they'll put more weight on the certainty of what they're seeing in the labor market. So overall, we also are expecting 1 to 2 rate cuts this year, and expecting rate cuts to accelerate in 2026 as the inflationary effects of tariffs fade. I think you brought up a key point, though, which is maintaining Fed independence through this period, this transition period in the economy, is of critical importance. You know, studies are pretty clear that independent central banks result in better outcomes for economies. During the post-pandemic period, anchored inflation expectations allowed for disinflation with limited impact on the labor market. And that was really a result of a credible Fed. And markets are attuned to the risks, so removal of the chair wouldn't really achieve objectives for the administration anyway. My sense is that if the chair's job were really threatened, it would lift longer-term rates. I think we saw a microcosm of that a couple weeks ago, and this would lift the borrowing costs for consumers and the Treasury anyway. So I think tensions have come off the boil. My sense is there will be an orderly transition to the new chair, which I think will benefit everyone.
So in terms of how to position in this environment, so many unknowns out there that we've covered, notably the long-term impacts of U.S. trade policy to economic conditions, no shortage of geopolitical risk out there. Where do you see opportunities at the moment, Patricia?
Yeah, as you mentioned earlier, it's interesting with all of the policy uncertainty that we spoke about. Equity markets are reaching new all-time highs. There is, you know, dispersion under the surface that reflects the changes happening. For example, baskets of tariff-impacted stocks are still down on the year, and a lot of the gains are being driven by optimism about AI technology. So, for example, tech stocks have risen a remarkable 45% since the lows of April. But overall, when you look at the risk premiums, you know, they give little room for surprises, and there's really some evidence that valuations are a little bit frothy. In this type of environment, what we try to do is just focus on the longer term opportunities. You know, think about what will be through the cycle good investments. You know, for us, infrastructure is an area of opportunity. There is really a longer run global need for investments in energy, digital infrastructure, and housing. And there's still good returns to be had, particularly in middle markets for folks that have the relationships. A second area is, you know, while credit spreads are tight, overall fixed income yields are attractive on a historical basis, and that provides protection against loss. And for if you have careful credit selection, that can also provide a little bit of downside protection against widening spreads. For managers with expertise, too, there's some areas that are still offer attractive yields, for example, like esoteric ABS. And those are areas that we're looking at.
So a wide range of positioning considerations for investors. Patricia, you've covered a lot with our listeners, our clients. Before we wrap up, any final thoughts, takeaways, anything you would want to reinforce today for our listeners?
I guess I would just say that in terms of policy shifts, it's still early innings for understanding the ultimate effects. This is going to keep us busy for a while. We will be monitoring developments, but from an investment standpoint, we continue to look through and think about what are good through the cycle investments to keep our investment returns in the right place.
Well, Patricia, always a pleasure. Very generous with your time, and thank you again for making it over to the studio on such a hot July Tuesday. A lot here we can, of course, follow up on. So looking forward to having you back on again soon.
It was a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to coming back.
Thank you, Patricia. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights, at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.